the National Archives podcast series, Big Ideas, Understanding Patterns of Behaviour for Users of Public Records, presented by Matthew Pearce. This talk was recorded on the 4th of August 2014 at the National Archives, Kew.
This came about last year. I took part in a competition online. I don't know if anyone here has heard of Kaggle. It's kind of like a turn stats into a sport, and you take part in a competition, you try and predict things. And I did one that was about recommending events to users of a website. So I did okay in that. I came in top 25%. So I thought, what could we do that was useful for TNA and the cultural stuff, as well as kind of interesting from a statistical perspective? At the same time, we had a conversation. There was a group about what innovative stuff could be done in TNA. And I kind of casually said at one point, well, you know, we could look at how you do search rankings in the same way that Google did. And I thought about it and thought, actually, how could we do that? And then kind of went further and further with the idea. So this is generally what came out of it. So looking at how users move around the records, and when I mean the records, I mean people actually ordering documents here on the site and taking them out on the site, not necessarily looking at things on the web. Although that's possible, you know, you've got to choose which particular bit of the problem you tackle first and what you look at. And I thought documents at the site's probably more interesting because it's not been done as much. Obviously, with websites, lots of people study how people click around websites, but not so much in an institution like this, maybe. So why should we care about this? Why should we bother doing it? Well, the usefulness of looking at how people navigate around sets of documents is, you know, mainly come out through search. If we cast our minds back to, you know, around 1998 or 1999, do you remember using sites like Lycos and Ask Jeeves, and how many people still use them? Not very many. I mean, you might still use Yahoo sometimes. It's got elements of things that are still useful in it, like their finance information is pretty good. And then you've got user-curated, sort of person-edited search engines like DMOZ, so actually getting a human being to go along and index every web page. It kind of got a little bit outrun by the way the web works, although it's still around, and I think it's still useful and used as a signal for other people. So how did Google come to dominate the search market? Well, there's probably a bunch of reasons. A really simple one is that the results were better than those of a lot of the other sites around at the time, and they also found a really good way to make money out of people searching for information, so they found a good way of selling their adverts. But in terms of how they improved their search results, they had this model. So the diagram you're looking at, it's just at the moment it's just a load of coloured blobs, but I want to persuade you to imagine that these coloured blobs are web pages, and these arrows between them are links between the web pages. So Google's model back in 1998, I'm sure they have much more sophisticated techniques now, was based on the idea that, say, if somebody materialises at page E, that's where they start off, then they randomly choose one of the outbound links from E, and then say they went to D, they would then have to bounce to A because that's the only way to get out of A. And then Google also said, well, people will randomly go to somewhere else on the website, on the entire internet, with a certain level of probability. And they ordered the search results. If you can imagine somebody bouncing around this system for a long time, where would they end up? What would the final destination be? And you can attach a probability to somebody ending up on, say, page B after bouncing around the system. So in this particular graph, this is from the explanation on Wikipedia. You can all go and look at it again. So B has the highest chance of somebody ending up there after a long time. So if this sounds drastically kind of simple, somebody just randomly chooses any link on a web page when you're there. I mean, imagine if you go to Amazon and how many links there are on a single web page. Their model was just based on you just you just click any one of them completely randomly. And it works really well. So it worked well enough to beat all these competitors, which is quite surprising, really. But nobody else was doing it. At the time, they were doing things like counting up numbers of keywords and how often they're used on web pages. This is just what I've described to you. Again, so just to emphasise, the size of those discs represents kind of how long, in the long run, how often would somebody land on one of those particular web pages. The maths behind this, and I promise not to use any equations in this presentation, although there are probably going to be quite a few pictures for people to look at. So the maths behind this idea of people bouncing around the system or random changes in the what we call the state of a system is quite old. Here's another simple example. It's a two-state version of the weather. It can either be sunny or rainy, and if it's sunny, it will stay sunny with probability 0.9, or it will become rainy with a small probability. Now, this way of looking at the world has proved to be quite useful. It has some limitations, but you can do all kinds of things with it. And so some of the things it's involved with at the moment, speech recognition. So if you make one noise, what's the probability that the next noise you make will be this other noise? Detection of security intrusion in computer systems. So if you're a legitimate user, you will behave in one particular way. If you're not, you might behave in a different way. So it can be used to help detect those kind of attacks. It's used in demographic analysis. So if somebody's employed, what's the chance in the next period they'll become unemployed, etc. It's used all over the place. It's also used as a component of other techniques. So one of the first things they did with a computer after they'd invented it was simulate explosions of a nuclear bomb with it. That's where they got the money from to build the computer. what can we use these techniques for? So Google was looking at the web, and the web has visible links, so you can actually see a particular document will say, I'm a document, I'm linked to this other document over there. Public records don't have that in the same way. Obviously, a lot of colleagues have put effort into curating the content and saying, you know, if you're looking at this, you might also want to look at that. But inside the documents themselves, there's not the link that you can just click to teleport to another document. So how can we do a similar thing? And the idea, as it came to me, was we could look at how our users navigated the records in the past. So there's a few different sets of data, I think, around the organisation about this. You can look at how people moved around the website and the documents that are already scanned, or you could look at how they moved around the internet catalogue for things that haven't been scanned, or you could look at which documents they actually took out. So decided to work with the data about the documents that people actually took out. One reason for this was I thought it'd be interesting to look at paper stuff. And the other reason was it seems to me that taking out a box of documents is quite a strong signal that somebody's interested in the contents. It's very cheap to, you know, click and then click back again and then go to another web page and decide that it wasn't for you. So it seemed like there'd perhaps be a bit more investment of a user's interest in what they've taken out physically, because it takes more time and effort to do that. Obviously, I'd really appreciate colleagues' opinions on, you know, whether that assumption is valid, and to sort of challenge that and say, well, actually, the information about how people use the web catalogue is just as valuable. So what we need to do then, using this form of data, is to look at how many individuals went from one series to another letter code to another piece. You can analyse it at different levels. So, say, for example, from the Duchy of Lancaster to the Palatinate of Lancaster. I've been looking at a few of these letter codes for the last few days. So that's just one example. So you might count the number of different transitions that people make. But if we've got a different kind of data, maybe we can do a different kind of analysis. Do we have to do exactly the same thing as, say, Google did? The first thing that I thought would be interesting is, can we ditch the assumption everyone behaves in the same way? Now, it seems to me there's lots of different kinds of people that use the archives. If we cast our minds back to this diagram, this is saying everybody bounces around this diagram. Imagine this is the whole of the internet. I'm really stretching your imaginations. Imagine this is the whole of the internet, and everyone bounces around with the same probabilities. Actually, there's lots of different people. Maybe some of the people bounce around in a different kind of way. How do you even model that? And the second thing is, instead of thinking about where in the long run would somebody end up, you ask the question, OK, what's the next thing that they're going to do, rather than where might they end up in a thousand time steps. So it's looking at the next thing they do rather than the long run. So to give some kind of visual clue about why you might want to model people as behaving differently to each other rather than thinking that everybody does the same thing, I'm going to show you an example. This idea gets bandied around quite a lot, which is that does more data beat better algorithms? Some people might have heard this idea and I thought it'd be interesting to test it. In some circumstances, the answer is no. So this is one of those graphs I threatened to show you. Here we have data, the black bars, it's just a histogram. Most people have seen these before. So the black bars are the real data that's in our sample, and this red line is the model that we're building out of the data that we've got in our sample. So we start off with 10 observations, and then we get 1,000 observations, and then to, you know, really go over the top, we can take 1,000,000 observations, and you can probably see from the graph that we have 2 blocks of data and the model only has 1 block in it. So we're saying that all this space is really likely. You know, this number 0 is the most likely thing to happen, but unfortunately it's not happened in the data at all. This isn't a complete failure, because at least you know that the number's likely to be somewhere near 0. It's not going to be off 1,000,000 or minus 2,000,000,000 or something crazy. But it just looks like you'd want a model that followed the data rather than failed to do so. So the point here is that if the models that you're using don't fit the data very well, just getting more and more data sometimes will have a limited benefit. If this is a really obvious problem, you know, you can just see there's 2 lumps in the data, why can't you just sort that out? Well, it has been fixed. I don't know if anybody here has heard of regression. So in regression, you'd say this was the outcome variable Y, and we'll use some other data like people's age or their shoe size or whatever to try and predict things. So you'll end up with people with a small shoe size and people with a large shoe size, and that will help you get over this problem of having 2 lumps in the data and only 1 in the model. So there's some problems with that. First, can you get hold of the data that you need to help you? So it might be impossible to collect. So there's, unless the government can force people to disclose their personal wealth, then they don't have access to that information. I don't know if anyone's heard these debates around Thomas Piketty at the moment. That's one of the problems. Can we actually get hold of the data? Another is, so X might be personal. You might be trying to predict something using personal data, and it's best not to do that if you don't have to. Obviously, for many applications, that's going to be essential, and you have to take real care there. So it would be good to be able to not have to use X if you don't have to, if it's personal. Another thing would be collections expensive. So you might have to go out and do surveys. These can get quite pricey, and then you might encounter the second problem, which is the data that you have, so this would be your shoe size or your height, is that actually going to help, or do you also need somebody's, do you need their hat size and their leg length as well? And if you didn't collect that, you could have a problem. There's other issues to do with things that, if you have another type of data that causes both the data that you have and the X variable, that's quite abstract. Sorry, guys. Here's an example. There was a study suggesting that people that take short breaks get cancer. Of course, there's another variable that causes short breaks and cancer, which is smoking. So do you know that you've included all the things that are equivalent to smoking in your data set? You might do. You can have arguments about that. But it can be a difficult problem to solve. In many cases, it's absolutely essential to do that. But can we dispense with that here for our problem? The answer I'm going to try and convince you is yes, we can. We can live without any personal data. We can just model how an anonymous user moves around the records without knowing anything else about the person. Don't need to know the shoe size or anything else about them. So this is just looking for what people do and not why they do it. So this is the idea of dispensing with those kind of explanatory variables and just looking at how people behave and not why they're behaving like that. So this I'm going to show you is called mixture modelling. And I don't expect to imagine that just from the name, so I'm going to show you an example. Imagine there are three different colours, and each of the colours is linked to a kind of behaviour. So we've got a red kind of behaviour, and a blue kind of behaviour, and a green kind of behaviour. And the data that people generate, so how they move around the records, or how tall they are, plus how wide they are and how heavy and what the shoe size is, can all be characterised by a red kind of behaviour, and everybody that's got a red behaviour will be similar, and people that have a blue behaviour would be similar, and people that had a green behaviour would be similar. Imagine that we only have three people. We've got to choose how to group those people into different what we call classes. So in the first row, we've put all three people in the same class. We're saying that they all do the same thing. They all have the same characteristic behaviour. So this is the same as the first diagram that I showed you, where we're assuming that everybody does the same thing. Then in the next three rows, we've got two different kinds of behaviour involved. We've got a red behaviour and a blue behaviour. And just for example, in the second row, we're saying that the first and the second person share a similar behaviour. The third person is doing something different. They have a different kind of behaviour. And on the last row, we're saying that everybody does something completely unique and they have their own characteristic kind of behaviour. So next, once we've decided like what kind of behaviours the people have, we can generate some data for them. In this case, the people are flowers. And we've got the sepal length, this is the observed data, and their petal width, this is a really famous data set. And as you can see, there's a characteristic green blob, and a red blob, and a blue blob. So that's what's really going on behind the scenes when we know what species of flower things are, and we've decided to give them colours. If we didn't already know that, because the data set was collected by a famous biologist in that case, we'd just see something like this, which is much less informative. And then we'd be faced with the problem of, OK, how do we recover these coloured groupings, these kinds of behaviour, just from seeing this kind of unlabeled data? So this is what we've got. This is what we're analysing in terms of user behaviour, something where we don't have the labels to begin with, we don't know how to group people, and we're trying to find that out. So there's ways of analysing these things. This is an attempt for modelling this data. It's the same data set as we were looking at, just at a different angle. This is assuming that all the data is behaved in the same way. So this is equivalent to the first row here. Everything's doing the same thing. In this second diagram, we're saying that there's two different kinds of characteristic behaviour, and it's picked out one characteristic behaviour here and another here, and that's equivalent to these kinds of rows. It's tried to sort people into groups. And in the last diagram, there's three characteristic kinds of behaviour corresponding to this last kind of row, and this happens to be the true model, so it's not surprising that it's picked out the correct sort of placing of the different kinds of behaviour. So this at the bottom here is an equivalent to this kind of model, but instead we've got the red line following the contours of the observed data exactly, which is nice, but we've got a problem. Here, the data set was from a famous biologist. He knows there's three species involved in the data. How many are there in our data? Could somebody tell me, please? It's not easy, so we have to take different steps to figure out how many different kinds of behaviour or clusters there are in the data. So I'm not actually going to try and explain to you the technicalities of how this works, but essentially, instead of going with a model that says everybody does the same thing, or there's two kinds of behaviour, or there's three, we average over what would the world be like if there was only one kind of behaviour, what if there was two, what if there was three, what if there was 1,000, what if there was 1,000,000 kinds of different behaviour. So we avoid having to answer the question directly just by saying what would the world be like if that was the case. This also, as you have more data, you can have more different kinds of behaviour enter the model. So it's effectively, it grows in richness as you get more data. Okay, so that was all scattered diagrams, and I was meant to be talking to you about time series, about how people move around the records over time. So it's nice, I can find some blobs on a scatter chart. Does it work for the stuff that we've got? Or what have we got? Our data, as I'm alleging to you, looks something like this. A user looks at the Home Office record, and then another one, and another one, and then a War Office record. Or maybe they look at something from the Met Police, then the Atomic Energy Authority, and then, you know, several other records. So that's the kind of data that I'm analysing here. What's the equivalent of the different kinds of behaviour for that kind of data? Well, if we remember back to this diagram that I showed you before, what we're saying is there's two, say, for example, there's two characteristic kinds of behaviour again. There's a blue behaviour and a red behaviour. What's different between them is differences in the probability of moving between different states. So maybe this one at the bottom is somewhere like Manchester, where I grew up, where it's quite likely to be sunny and then go to rainy. And maybe the blue behaviour is more like the south of France, where once it gets sunny, it stays that way for quite a long time. So that's the kind of equivalent that we're running here. This is some randomly generated data using three different kinds of behaviour. There's red, blue and green again to help people get some kind of continuity in what we're talking about. So the numbers on this axis are the different states, so like sunny or rainy or Amazon, Google, Bing, whatever. And then we're looking at how the series moves around over time. So what's the chance of it being sunny and then going to rainy? And then over here, we have it's a matrix that shows the similarity between different time series. So all these really are, say, the blue behavior time series, and this block represents like the red behavior time series, and this is the green behavior time series. So we've not plugged into the model the fact that there are three different behaviors. It's just figured that out. It works with 2, 3, 4, 5, however many you like. The advantage of using some simulated data is just to check whether your software works, because you know what the answer should look like. If you've used three different types of behavior, you should find three different blocks of similarity between the different time series. The other thing that this is telling you is that what we get out of this is the similarity between one person and another person, or one flower and another flower, or one time series and another time series, rather than a neat answer saying this person has a red behavior or a blue behavior. That was quite ugly, that last slide. One of the reasons is that the time series were length 30. So on these slides, this is two-dimensional. We've got one dimension and another. I would have to have something with 30 axes on it to plot them on a scatter plot. And human visual system doesn't kind of work that way. Then also there's around about 110 different parameters, so you can't plot those either on one plot. So that's quite difficult. So if we apply this technique to user data, how people have moved around the records, what do we get out? We can show you what the network looks like for an individual. So here I'll show you. This is the matrix. So if we can remember back about those sort of movements between something being sunny and it being rainy, this is kind of the equivalent for public records, as seen here, for a particular individual. So if I used a different set of time series, if I used a different individual's data as an input to this, you'd get out a different map. But for this particular time series, this is the map that you get out. My computer screen's off, so it's difficult to get the names of these things. But here you've got things like the railways, and then you've got the Rail Commission, and these things are from the British Rail Libraries. This is from British Rail Libraries, and you've got some since the Coal Authority, and then we've got the Ministry of Power down here. So you kind of get out these thematic groupings. Here's another sort of grouping that's quite kind of easy to see, or easy-ish to see what's going on. So I had a look at these before, and they all seem to be to do with old court records, really, like old documents. I'm not sure, somebody will have to tell me. So this is like the King's Bench. You've got the Court of Common Pleas, assizes, the King's Wardrobe, which I believe is quite an important station at a previous point in history. This is to do with Durham, which I think was an important legal site. That's the Star Chamber, which I wouldn't want to visit too often. So it's figured out that these different sets of records should be fairly close to one another. Of course, when you've got a visualisation like this, there's 315 different sets of records looking at this level of depth. So the actual matrix of numbers, it's like a spreadsheet, 315 rows, 315 columns. It's nearly 100,000 numbers. So a lot of information gets lost when you squish things down into two dimensions to look at them. So I was kind of pleased that you can find many groups that look like they have semantic coherence at all. Because when we're looking at these diagrams, you could be looking at many things that are arranged in parallel, and you simply happen to be staring at them all in a line, so everything gets squished together. But you can see some areas of common meaning there. And just to convince you that these were different, here's one for a different time series. So here you'll see a situation where you've got the Ministry of Energy, this is labour relations or something, and then what was AB? It's the Atomic Energy Authority. So it is another power related one, and I think that's pensions. And what was FV? Something, it was something to do with trade and industry, I think. Yeah, it's trade and industry. So at the bottom here, we seem to have like a cluster that's heavy industry and power generation things. So it might be that whichever time series we put into this, the person had been interested in things to do with energy policy. But it could be just that they were interested in something completely elsewhere in the chart, and they just happened to look like other people that look like they like documents to do with coal and atomic energy. And if they did happen to go and look at something from the Ministry of Energy, then we'd expect them to go and look at coal documents next, if they ever did that. So this was just about how long it takes to do this. Obviously, there's a trade-off between how rich your model is and how long it takes to run it. It takes quite a long to run one of these things. Had to use parallel computing. All these stickers that you get on your computer that say, like, i5 or whatever, a lot of software doesn't actually use them, and a lot of the off-the-shelf analytical software you get doesn't always use it. So you have to explicitly do that. Quite tricky. The other thing is, when you've got these like huge numbers of different edges, if you have 2,000 documents, you don't want to fill in. If you've got a big spreadsheet, you don't want to fill it with zeros. So you basically kind of have a spreadsheet where you've only got the cells that have something in them, and the rest don't kind of exist. So you're not filling up your computer with nonsense. So the other issue was, if we look back at the beginning. These numbers, that how big's the circle, was just the long-run probability that somebody ends up looking at those documents, and we want to look at what's the chance of the next thing they do being a move from the War Office to Ministry of Defence. For example, if you've got a data set where everybody ends up looking at War Office documents, maybe you've got a researcher who really wants to look at rail documents, and they'd really hate it if everything ended up getting weighted way towards War Office documents, maybe. So if we can just think about the next thing they do, it saves us from that problem. So we're just focusing on the choice that somebody faces here and now, like, what do I do next, rather than what do I do at some point in the far distant future. So this model, doing the clustering, looking at how similar users are to each other, does explain a test data set. So we put 1,000 time series to one side and then look at how likely they are under the original kind of quote-unquote Google-style model. I'm sure they have massively, massively more sophisticated things now. So this is versus the kind of use from 1998, and the clustering kind of model does explain the data a lot better. And the here and now question does save some computer resources, because once you've done this analysis, it takes a long time to run. It's easier to get the answer to the question, what are people doing next? Conclusion. Is this data science? It's something that's been talked a lot about recently. I don't know. Maybe it is. The journals I use to write the software, etc., were in statistics and machine learning and computer science. So you'll tend to find that there's a lot of people that kind of move between different disciplines rather than something else out there called data science. The other thought that I had, you can do this kind of work because we've got a log of different transactions that took place in the past. It's all quite routine stuff. I think perhaps in the future you'll find that there's other routine stuff that at the moment we suggest that people get rid of it because it doesn't seem particularly interesting, but it could be interesting to some kind of computer-equipped analyst. So, like, emails between different departments saying, you know, how many biscuits shall I order for the meeting? That tells you something. That tells you that one department's talking to another department and that they go to the same meetings. So if you can imagine looking at some kind of graph like this in the future, where instead of it being to do with time series and records, it's to do with different teams in a ministry and how close they are to each other based on how often they communicate. And you can look at how things changed over time. So you could do all kinds of interesting things with that. And there's plenty of people around that do things like that now. Like when Enron went the wrong way, people looked at how emails were exchanged within the organisations. And I think there'll be more and more people doing that kind of research in the future. And kind of having access to low-level, kind of trivial information can actually be quite useful in that situation. So that's my closing thought.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.